Ms. Hoffman, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Judge. 3 minutes, please.
You may begin.
Thank you. Bonnie Hoffman, on behalf of Jonathan Lamar Marks, we respectfully request that this court suppress the evidence that was recovered from the search warrants executed at Mr. Marks' home, as those search warrants were not supported by probable cause and the good faith exception did not apply in this case. Alternatively, we'd ask that the court remand this case to the trial court for a hearing consistent with the ruling in Franks v. Delaware. I suggest to the court that when we look at the case, there are two search warrants, and the second search warrant is wholly subsumed in the first. If the first search warrant fails, so does the second. When we look fundamentally at this case, really what we're asking ourselves is, was there a sufficient temporal and causal connection between the phone that was recovered across the street from the bank and the apartment that the search warrant was executed at?
Ms. Hoffman, let me ask you, you cite that, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this properly, the Anzualda case?
That's what we're going to call it today.
Okay. Doesn't that case differ from this case in that it was a six-month time period as opposed to a 48-hour time period?
Well, it doesn't. So when we look at the Anzualda case, what we see is that the murder happened 6 months before the search warrant was executed and requested in that case. And the complaint the court had and the reason the court felt that the search warrant in that case had failed is because there lacked a temporal element to it, any explanation as to when these transactions happened. When we actually look at the contents of the affidavit, in this case, we have some of that same problem. Now, the phone's connection to the bank is certainly very temporal. It is found within 24 hours. It appears to have been used within 48 hours. And so the phone's connection to the crime is strong, temporally strong, and certainly causally strong. What's missing is a connection from that phone to the address, and that's where that lack of temporal connection and lack of causal connection exists. Because what we have when we look at the affidavit to take the phone to this particular apartment is no indication as to the time element for any of the messages that are recovered. The search warrant simply reads that we looked at the text messages. The messages contained the name John or Jonathan. It contained a reference to a particular building number on Beechwood Terrace. We know from the search warrant that that's an apartment building. And then a statement that a law enforcement database links Jonathan Lamar Marks to this particular address, this particular apartment, but there's no temporal aspect to that either. Now, the search of the database had to have happened recently, but the information in the database, because that's what's key, is not that I searched the database now and today the database says those things exist.
But if the police call if they're looking for a particular person and not articles of clothing, and they call the DMV, and the DMV gives them a last known address of, I have no idea whether that address is good or bad, but if your theory is correct, and I can't demonstrate that the person, and it's been 2 years since the person renewed their license, that's not a good search?
There's this fundamental difference between a DMV database and what's designated in this affidavit, and we have to go by the information we're given, which is just law enforcement database. And that is this, a DMV database, inherently we can follow certain expectations. A person's address with the DMV is their home address, and a person has an obligation to provide a current home address to DMV. This law enforcement database just says that there is a link between Jonathan Lamar Marks and a particular apartment at this building. What we don't know about that law enforcement database is whether that link was made because Mr. Marks was a one-time guest there, because it was made 6 months ago, 6 years ago. There's no information to give us an indication as to whether that law enforcement database is like a DMV database where we can have some reliance that it should be current. And that's the distinction. When we look at this piece of information, we're missing that temporal aspect in any of it, the name, the address, the link. And when we don't have that temporal connection, we don't have a right to use that piece of information that I'll search for.
But everything in the affidavit is true.
Just because the information in the affidavit is literally true doesn't make it reliable. No.
But everything is true.
Everything in that affidavit is literally true.
Okay. And using the and this gets into your Frank's argument a little bit, using the term misleading in its ordinary, everyday meaning, there's nothing in the affidavit that's misleading, because the inferences that one would draw from the information in the affidavit is that the phone was used by the person who committed the robbery, that the person who owned the phone is named John, and that the person, and that John lives at this apartment. And all of those things prove to be true. And I know you can't use the ultimate conclusion to prove it, but none of that is misleading. All of those inferences are, in fact, true.
I disagree with the court that we can make those the two inferences that the owner of the phone is John and that the owner of the phone lives at that address. I think the first part, the phone is connected to the robbery, the burglary, I think is really without question.
Well, right, but you're objecting to the magistrate drawing those inferences, it seems to me, but those inferences do in fact prove to be true, so they're not crazy inferences. Aren't they definitionally reasonable?
It's just they're not. We can't look behind the fact that we found the thing we're looking for as validation for what we're doing. If that were the case, then we wouldn't have any of these arguments because none of these cases would ever come to the court if after executing the search warrant it turned out it was the wrong Jonathan in the wrong house and we wouldn't be here at all. But when we look at that, the language in the affidavit, and we have to separate out a couple of things. When we look at the probable cause aspect, we can't look beyond the four corners of the affidavit. The four corners of the affidavit don't say the search of the phone indicates the owner of the phone is Jonathan. It simply says that the phone has text messages using the name John or Jonathan, and the phone has an address. Not that the context or the content of the way that that's listed gives an indication that the owner of the phone is Jonathan or the most recent user of the phone is Jonathan, or that the address that's listed is in fact the address that appears to be associated with the owner, such as come pick me up at my house at 123 Maple Street, I'll be there, love John.
Is there enough information on the phone itself and the law enforcement database that if they had just included all of that information listed, it appears that the messages are being sent to somebody named John, and he lists what appears to be, if the affidavit had said that, appears that his address is this, would you say that was sufficient?
I think we're getting closer, assuming that that's a fair inference to draw from the information on the messages. And I don't know that you can completely draw that from the context of the messages and the way that the officer picked and chose certain pieces of information. So, for example, there was more than the name Jonathan on there. There were other names on there. There was more than the address that was listed on Beachwood Terrace. There were several other addresses. And really fundamentally, which wasn't highlighted in the briefs, but I think it's important for the court to note, when you go back and look at the text message log itself, what we see is the address information, which was a single entry in February, the burglary happening in August, there's a gap. So message, I think it's 256, they go in reverse order. So message 256 is from June 23rd. Message 257, the message immediately preceding it, is from February 10th. There is a significant gap in the phone with no other information. So now take that February date and connect it with, in essence, a July use of the name John or Jonathan to allow that conclusion that the current owner of the phone lives at the address that we saw back 6 months prior. And that's why that temporal and causal connection is important. We can't simply just pick and choose pieces of information. If the officers had said, we searched the law enforcement database and that database revealed that Jonathan Lamar Marks has been, is living at this address, not connected to, not linked to, but living at this address, as of a contact we had 6 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago or 4 months ago, we'd be getting closer. But the problem is, in this case, the affidavit is completely silent as to any of that. And when we even go behind it, we look at that application of the good faith exception, which changes the analysis a little bit. And so when we're looking at the probable cause and we're looking purely at the four corners of the affidavit, and then when we move beyond that and say, well, I like to think of it as sort of a near miss. Let's assume that the affidavit was no good because it lacked that temporal information. So the magistrate made a mistake in issuing it. We have a near miss. We have something close enough between what was in the affidavit and what was known to the officer to collectively still say that the officer acted in good faith and relying on the magistrate issuing the search warrant, and suggest that we don't, because if we're going to adopt that the officer knew information, such as one more of the context, the reference, for example, of the apartment number in the address. So the search warrant just references the street address and that it's an apartment building. We know that from the search warrant, it's an apartment building, with no information whether this apartment building has 6 apartments or 400 apartments. But with a name like Jonathan, I don't think there's anything unique about the name to say that seeing the name Jonathan tells me that any person I find in the apartment building named Jonathan must be the Jonathan without knowing how many apartments are there.
The trial judge made some pretty specific findings. And one was that there was no intent to mislead or deceive, which gives you a very high burden on the Franks argument, which may be why we haven't heard much about the Franks argument. But the second was that he, now knowing all of what you've just argued, found that there was probable cause to support the affidavit. Once again, I know we can't go backwards, but on the good faith exception part, how, given that it was an experienced trial judge who's very familiar with these issues, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if he thought sufficient information had been provided and he thought it was sufficient for probable cause, under Leon, how in the world can the detective be held to a higher standard of legal knowledge than the trial judge?
It'd be no different than any other time that this court has stepped in and said, you know, the trial judge has made a conclusion. We believe the trial judge erred in that conclusion. And we believe that the officer didn't have a basis, the good faith exception didn't apply. This court has done that before, and this case should be no different. Ultimately, fundamentally, when we look behind that the officer had a good faith basis to believe that this existed, we have to, I think, look both at both things, both the things the officer knew, such as the link between the apartment number, which is in the text messages but not in the affidavit, to the address. We also have to look at the fact that the officer knew the address was 6 months old, that the officer didn't include the fact that the address was from 6 months ago in the affidavit. And while they're not required to include everything and pick and choose what they include, we have to look at that as well. The officer would have been aware of the gap in the information. The officer would have been aware of the differing addresses that were in the information. The officer would have been aware that there was no other information about this database link to justify a connection between Mr. Marks and the database and the particular apartment.
Ms. Hoffman, the Commonwealth argues on brief that the error was harmless. What's your response to that?
I would suggest that it's not when we look at the totality of the evidence in this case. And so we see from the evidence...
Well, this is an enormous lot of circumstantial evidence, isn't it?
There is a fair bit of circumstantial evidence, but we have to look at the role that this particular piece of evidence played in the case. And we see both from the prosecutor...
What evidence was it?
What evidence was there against Mr. Marks? There certainly was the description that he was not at home at the time that his girlfriend, his wife, had come home. He wasn't there. She saw him the next morning.
What items were recovered?
From the search warrant?
Yeah.
The items that were recovered were the pants,
okay,
the hat, the...
Anything other than the sneakers, sweatpants, and black hat?
There was a key that was described as being identical
to the minute key
that was found at the scene as well. And the fact that those pieces of clothing, as the Commonwealth described, you have to now sort of suspend your belief that I think he used the phrase, one in a billion chance, that Mr. Marks would have at his house.
Are you saying that in the absence of these items, the key, the hat, the sneakers, and the pants, the evidence is insufficient to convict your client?
I'd suggest that without those pieces of evidence, the question about whether the evidence would be sufficient is something that should have gone back to the jury, and that it is not harmless to say the inclusion of this evidence didn't otherwise tip the balance. I think the prosecutor's reliance on it tells us that the evidence tipped the balance for him and for the court as well.
But
the court has any other questions, I'd like to reserve my last 2 minutes. Thank you.
Begin when you're ready, Ms.
Good morning. May it please the court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald, on behalf of the Commonwealth. The trial court in this case did not err in failing to suppress these items. The magistrate in this case did have a substantial basis to find probable cause that these items of clothing would be at the particular apartment to be searched. That affidavit, as the court is aware, listed the crime with particularity, the items to be sought, the place that they were looking for, and it did give a reason to believe that those items would be found at that place. That reason is that the cell phone, which was found at the scene, had the name Jonathan in it, had this address in it, and then the police corroborated that information by looking in their police database and found out that, in fact, someone with that name did live at that apartment, and he had a history of burglary and larceny crimes.
Well, the affidavit doesn't specify that the database revealed that he lived there, did it? It just said he's linked to that address, and the appellant places a great deal of significance on linked. I don't know whether the significance is warranted or not, but I would ask you to comment on it.
And I did misspeak. It does say links. However, the person who drafted that affidavit is a police officer, and this court's case law, as well as the Supreme Court and federal courts, have talked about how we have to understand that these people are law enforcement officers who are drafting these affidavits in haste in the middle of an ongoing investigation. And we don't need to dissect in hindsight the particular words that they use. I think that if the court will look, the case law of this court often uses the word links. I don't think it's significant. I think it's particularly significant in this case, though, when you look at the way that she uses that word and then uses kind of that apartment in the rest of the affidavit. She says later that Jonathan Marks of this address. And so I think when we talk about how she believes that he, Jonathan Marks of 140 whatever, Beachwood Terrace, in the next line, combined with the phrase links, I think it's significant that she believes that he either lives there, stays there, et cetera. And it's important, we don't need to prove that he lives there. We're looking to see where the clothing that was worn at the robbery might be found. And in this case, that is closely tied to the crime scene, closely tied to the cell phone there. It's the most recent information the police have regarding this gentleman's whereabouts. I don't think it's significant that we don't have more information from the police database. Certainly, DMV records have been relied upon by law enforcement. Wanted bulletins have been relied upon by law enforcement. The Supreme Court has held that pistol reliance by Richmond Circuit Court or Richmond police officers, their kind of internal police database. It's reasonable to look at that. The police have every incentive to keep their law enforcement databases up to snuff. I would argue at least as much, if not more, than DMV does. And DMV does the best it can as a Commonwealth agency, but I think as a matter of common sense, which the magistrate was entitled to use his common sense and life experience, these kind of records are the kind that are relied upon by law enforcement. It would certainly be reasonable for this law enforcement officer to rely on that kind of information. Because the affidavit the Commonwealth submits was sufficient for the magistrate to find a reasonable basis for probable cause, which is, again, lower than probable cause. So to the extent that, as Your Honor noted, the trial court found that there was probable cause here, certainly the magistrate would have a substantial basis for finding that same probable cause existed. And as the court further noted, even if the magistrate got it wrong in this case, Detective Cunningham was certainly acting in good faith when she executed this search warrant. Looking at the text messages themselves show the context this information arose in. It's clear from those text messages, you know, hey Joel, this is Jonathan. Hey Jonathan, what's up? Jonathan is the person who owns or who is using this cell phone. And those Jonathan references do go back a substantial ways. And I would note that to the extent that the early text messages from around February don't say his name, he's texting with his girlfriend. He's texting with Pinedo and her cell phone number, and she identifies her cell phone number in the record. They have a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, so looking back through the text messages, even if Jonathan is not mentioned, the person who's owning the phone has a romantic relationship with this woman whose cell phone number we know, and we can see that going all the way back through these text messages. And the address is an address where it says, come pick me up. Here, the other address that was mentioned is an address that says, here's where the job is. And that's it's on page 29. The address of the job is this address in Herndon. Contrast that with, come pick me up at this particular address, particularly when that address has been confirmed by the police database. The officer acting in good faith has, again, a lower burden than even the magistrate does. She has to have an objectively reasonable basis to rely on the magistrate's determination, and certainly she had that here. I would submit briefly also that this matter was harmless in the end. The defendant had black workout clothes in his house. I think anybody who goes to the gym would have black workout clothes in their house. Certainly I do. The other evidence presented at trial was overwhelming. We have the video of the break-in, which the jury saw and could compare to the man that was sitting in front of them. We have the defendant admitting the cell phone found the scene was his, the backpack found the scene was his. Said he hadn't seen the cell phone recently. However, his girlfriend said she texted it, or she received a text from him on it the night before. His cell tower information showed him going to the bank. The jury heard a phone call from jail in which he asked his girlfriend to lie about his whereabouts that night. He had no alibi, and certainly the combined force of this information, regardless of whether he had workout clothes in his house, was sufficient to convict him under these circumstances. I'd be happy to answer questions the court has. I'd like to rest on my brief on the Franks issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
Just to address maybe some of the factual issues that have been raised, and one of them is this issue about the address, because while the Attorney General's office and the Commonwealth has pointed to one address and a description that it was a job address, we go back and look at the text messages, you'll see there are three additional addresses listed, none of which have a connotation that they're associated with the job. The message is 194, which gives a specific address on Love Lane, message 195, which gives a specific address on Lakeview Center, and message 253, which gives a specific address on Pearl Street. And the same is true with the name. And the same is true to draw the conclusion that the exchanges are with his girlfriend. That's a piece of information that's found out after the fact. There's not a communication in there that says, by the way, I'm writing to my girlfriend. We know now that it is, but that's not the measure. The measure was at the time that it was issued. At the time that it was issued, we don't have that connection.
What is your response to the argument that the reference to a link to the address is not the only reference in the affidavit to the address? Jonathan Marks of 2027 Beechwood Terrace, number 103. I think most everybody would say that just applying normal rules of English, you would conclude that he lives there, and that's what's being represented in the affidavit.
I'd suggest that that's not the only interpretation you can draw. And again, we have to balance the choice with the word links and the concept that a police database is only interested in having current address information, current connection information. I'd suggest the opposite conclusion to be drawn, which is a police would have an interest in getting as broad a net, as tangential a connection as possible.
Well, right, but we know she's looked at the database, we know it's linked, and then she says, the detective says, Jonathan Marks of 2027 Beechwood Terrace. Why does not suggest that what she's representing is that the link is that he lives there?
I'd suggest that the court see my time expired.
You can answer that one.
It's simply a conclusory remark that isn't supported by the four corners of the affidavit.
Well, it's in the affidavit.
I'd suggest, though, that the conclusion that is proof of an address is not necessarily, it's not the only conclusion you can draw from that, nor a reasonable one. If that were the case, Kummel has the opportunity at this hearing to have presented evidence, such as the testimony from the officer or the database information, to establish that that was the case.
Thank you very much.
Thank
we'll come down and greet counsel.
All rise.